6. Tracking down the truth. Mockery ends where understanding begins. Marie von Ebner-Eschenbach, 1830-1916. Where are the traces of the extraterrestrials? Everywhere. Most people fail to see them. There is only circumstantial evidence and nothing is proven. But whoever does not see the traces and signs of them in the great legends and mythologies of the world must be half blind. Since nearly everyone seems to have this vision deficiency, one may ask why these ETs did not leave more obvious markers and indicators of their visit here. What good are religious texts and tales from ancient times? What use are strange traditions of impossible numbers if everyone can make of them what they will? Proof is needed that cannot be refuted. Only then will science sit up and take notice. Is that so? But how often in the past were scientific proofs demonstrated and then rejected because they did not fit in with a religious worldview? How often has one branch of science proved something, only to have it refuted by another branch that did not like the sound of it? How often have irrefutable scientific proofs, yes, this has happened, been generally undermined for ideological reasons? The geneticists in every laboratory could recount epics on such a theme. They can prove with ease how reasonable, important, and forward-looking genetic research is. And how does the media respond? Hands off! Dangerous! Dreadful! Should be outlawed immediately! What did Albert Einstein say? Two things are infinite: the universe and human stupidity. Although he was still unsure about the former. So what kind of irrefutable proof could the extraterrestrials have left behind? Some kind of sculptures on cliffs or mountains? No. Over thousands of years they would crumble and erode. Might they have put up some kind of buildings, say pyramids? No, for the same reason as above. If bacteria, termites, or self-righteous people do not destroy such buildings, earthquakes, floods, volcanic eruptions, and other natural catastrophes would do the job. But could they perhaps have left an indestructible text somewhere? Could they? Where, then? In which building? Inside which mountain? No, for the same reason as before. But why is a building necessary? The ETs could have left evidence behind in a metal form or in some artificial material. At any rate, something that would stand the test of time. There are, actually, such remains, but unfortunately, religion forbids their scientific investigation. And from which indestructible metal would the tablets of the gods be made? Silver? Gold? Platinum? All of them can be melted down. Steel, then? Super steel? But where are the thick tank plates from the First World War? They have all rusted. And what about the remains of the thousands of airplanes which were shot down in the Second World War? That was only yesterday, comparatively speaking. Even the few remains that are preserved in museums will have disintegrated in 1,000 years' time. But the guardians of the sky must have left waste materials lying around. Surely these could be found? No. It would be absurd after such a long time to expect to discover objects that had been thrown away. Nature has absorbed them. But there must be some way of transporting messages from the past to the future. I agree. But for this to happen, two conditions have to be fulfilled. The message must be in an indestructible form. The message must never fall into the hands of the wrong generation. Who is the wrong generation? All those who are incapable of properly evaluating such information. They would wreck the message without deciphering it. If it was in the form of higher mathematics, only a mathematically highly advanced society could decipher it. If it consisted of microfilm, only a society could understand it which can read microfilm. If it was coded in computer language, only those who had advanced knowledge of computer technology would make sense of it. If the message was left in the sterile environment of the moon, the almost sterile environment of Mars, or perhaps in a satellite orbiting the Earth, it would only be discovered by a society that had begun to voyage into space. And if the message was concealed in genetic material, only a society capable of deciphering DNA would come across it. But in order for a society even to think of looking for such a message, signs and traces must be left, indicators that stimulate a search. What I do not know about does not make me sweat. The message of the gene. It would seem likely, at the present stage of Paleo-SETI research, that the extraterrestrial's message may have been implanted into human genes and also into those of specific forms of vegetation. The ETs of thousands of years ago relied upon human, or rather scientific, curiosity. The gods created man in their image, says tradition. They did not only create man, however, but also, according to legend, exquisite and unique plant forms. All that the extraterrestrials needed to do was to implant a few gene sequences, modifying the DNA, also called artificial mutation, into the human genome and certain divine plants. Curiosity is an expression of intelligence, which is a quality that became characteristic of the human race after this artificial mutation had taken place. All our knowledge derives from curiosity about the world. It was scientific curiosity that stimulated us to look for subatomic particles, to investigate the origins of the universe, and to dissect ourselves down to the very tiniest speck of DNA. Since humans and plants continually reproduce and pass on genetic information from one generation to the next, the messages of the extraterrestrials are very likely to be discovered somewhere within ourselves, and perhaps also in a few species of divine plant. The two conditions I mentioned would then be fulfilled. The message would remain indestructible for as long as humans and plants continue to exist. The message would only be found by a generation that was capable of investigating molecular biology, genetics, and deciphering genetic codes. The second premise automatically involves a whole range of other scientific expertise and technological development. No one can study molecular biology without a high-resolution microscope. One has to be able to look into the inside of a cell. No one who knows nothing of the double helix of DNA structure can decipher the genome either. Specific instruments and processes are necessary for all this, which can only be provided by a society which has attained a corresponding level of technological skill. An electron screen microscope is just as unthinkable without electricity as is overseeing the billions of potential sequences and combinations within DNA without a computer. A whole army of mathematicians would be unable to replace the work of a computer. These thoughts reveal a further aspect of the Paleo-SETI hypothesis which irritates many critics. Why now? Why should we suddenly now think of looking for traces of the ETs in human history? To put it bluntly, the universe could not care less when we start searching for ETs, but we will start searching for them when we are ready to, which is now. If our science knew nothing about genetics for another 100 years, we would not possibly be able to start looking for genetic traces of extraterrestrials until then. I have written in many books about the evolution of human beings from the race of hominids. The most recent discoveries of conservative anthropology just make me smile. The newspapers tell us that fossil research has now shown that the generally accepted theory of human origin may need to be revised. This is because Chinese scientists have been investigating a pre-human skull that is 200,000 years older than it ought to be, according to previous theories. One has hardly finished digesting this piece of news when American anthropologists announce that they have dated three skulls using the most up-to-date methods and found them to be 800,000 years older than Homo erectus, the upright forerunner of man. There is disagreement about whether human beings originated in Africa or Java. Who knows? Perhaps they came from China, Or perhaps fossil remains will soon be found in Japan that will ruin all the present theories. I actually think that anthropological research is not investigating an intelligent human species, but ape descendants and mutations. Does it really matter much whether ape bones are 1.8 or 3 million years old? I am not in the least interested in discovering when exactly an ape species learned to stand upon its hind legs and stretch its toes out straight. I do not dispute that whole branches of the ape family kept changing throughout the last 20 million years and that our own ancestors descended from the same race. But all this actually has nothing to do with Homo sapiens developing intelligence. It was the gods who created the intelligent human being. Of course, they took the raw material of the hominid race for this purpose. Where else would they find it? And geneticists will discover the genes which these gods implanted in us. The only question is whether they will be allowed to reveal their results. For this would be proof of the Paleoceti hypothesis. The starter's pistol for the race for truth has long ago been fired. The geneticists, razor-sharp and on the ball, and not all that religious, will provide the proof we need. Machines to make us transparent. At the end of February 1987, the scientific magazine Nature, volume 325, announced that Japanese geneticists had developed a super-sequencer, an apparatus that was capable of deciphering a million DNA characters per day. Since then, time has not stood still. The Human Genome Project is in full swing. Whenever governments hold back funding because ideological blinkers limit their view, industry steps in instead. In the USA alone, there are roughly 1,300 private and semi-private gene companies. A few miles from Washington, the gene robots, the super-sequencers, work round the clock. There, in the suburb of Gaithersburg, behind a small front garden, one can find the Institute for Genomic Research, TIGER. 30 of the sequencer machines stand in a sparkling, clean hall. The director of TIGER, Dr. Craig Ventner, is a far-sighted man. He has given his gene robots mythological names such as Hercules, Thor, Jupiter, and Bacchus. The old gods are coming back to life. Every day, he tells me, the TIGER robots are deciphering chain sequences of about 600 genes, and about 500,000 base molecules are being stored. In no more than 10 years, every geneticist should have access to the complete human genome. Then the transparent human being will be a reality. But TIGER is just one fish in the sea of the Human Genome Project. Various universities round the globe have become involved in decoding genetic material. Large pharmaceutical companies likewise. In countries in which a regressive political situation has prevented gene research, the multinationals have moved their research elsewhere. In the field of genetics, the old truth of military technology also applies: if we do not do it, someone else will. And what are they doing? The human being possesses about 110,000 genes, which are dispersed among about 3,000 million DNA segments. At the time of writing, about 10,000 genes have been investigated. We know now what their function is. 10,000 decoded genes compared with the 110,000 in the human genome may seem little, but more and more super-sequencers are at work, and computers are continually storing and comparing their gene snippets. And also, the more genes that become known, the easier it is to home in on the others. How can the layman understand this process of decoding? What is happening? Genes are tiny segments in the DNA double helix. One can also imagine this double helix as a kind of rope ladder or a zip whose fastener consists of nucleic acid chains. Every cell in the human body contains a DNA strand. And just as a rope ladder has rungs, so too does the DNA. Four different kinds of chemical composition. These are called adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. Together with the phosphoric acid sugar base, several rungs of the rope ladder form the nucleotide sequences. These are, as it were, the letters of the genetic code. But the rungs of the rope ladder do not just stick to the rope without any connection. The nitrogenous base material adenine is keen to combine with thymine, and the guanine feels itself magnetically drawn to cytosine. In terms of the Lego brick model, every brick does not fit every other. Now imagine the four basic materials in four different colors and stretch out the whole rope ladder to a length of 100 meters. In this model, the DNA is the rope ladder and the colors are the letters of the genetic code. What then occurs? Within the cell, the DNA opens its fastening segment by segment, rung by rung, and begins to double itself. The nucleotides adhere to the basic material they correspond with, the chemical compositions splashing about in the cell, which we ingest through our food and which our organs take up and reduce to their components. Thus, a new DNA strand grows which is absolutely identical to the old one. The cell now divides and the new cell again splits its DNA strand and reproduces itself. So a cell dump grows and finally forms a body. And in every single cell is to be found the blueprint of the whole. The human being possesses about 50 billion cells, in every one of which his whole program is contained. Every letter of the genetic code is responsible for different growth and functions within the human body. If something starts mutating in some portion of the DNA so that, say, liver cancer is produced, it should be possible to cut out the particular genetic strands responsible and replace them with a health-producing combination of genetic material. But in order to do this, the geneticists must first know exactly which combination is responsible for which functions. This decoding is what the supersequencers are working at. And why do we need to know about genetics at all? Are we not meddling in God's work? Can we not just be what we are and leave well alone? Because of environmental factors such as radiation and chemicals which enter the cells through polluted foodstuffs, defects arise in the genetic process. Perhaps a cancerous tumor suddenly starts growing that can attack all the cells. Such defects are passed on to following generations. If we want both to heal the sick person and prevent the defective genes being passed on, we have to know which section of the rope ladder is producing the wrong kind of rungs. Then we can start making repairs to the genetic structure. And this is actually already happening. Today, hormones are produced by genetic means. There are genetically produced insulin, enzymes, proteins, and all kinds of microbes which are used to neutralize spilt slicks of raw oil or to split up harmful bacteria. All sorts of medicines are already produced genetically. For instance, anti-inflammatory, antidepressive, and bodybuilding drugs and vitamins. The food and washing powder industries, unbeknownst to the consumer, have been using genetic enzymes for a long time already. Teenagers, proud of their new genes with the stonewashed effect, are unaware that they have to thank genetically engineered enzymes. The age of the gene supermarket is getting into full swing, and a brand new profession is joining the ranks of older occupations, the gene therapist. Not of this world. But what will the geneticists make of it when they find more and more genetic information attached to the rope ladder that could not possibly have derived from our ancestors? It is relatively easy to compare, after all. Our relatives, the gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans, are still around. What will people think when they find out exactly which gene segment is responsible for human speech, and at the same time discover, by comparison with the gene composition of the ape family, that this segment suddenly made its appearance, rather than evolving slowly? And what will people say when human genetic material comes to light that cannot be of earthly origin because it does not fit with any known life form? How will they react when geneticists investigate the mummies of ancient Egypt and discover, beyond any possible doubt, that the oldest pharaohs, the ones with very large skulls, who asserted that they were sons of the gods, contain genetic material that could never have come from the Earth, material that is devoid of the intermediary stages of evolutionary theory. And what will they stammer and mumble when the very same genetic patterns are found on the other side of the world in the pre-Inca rulers, the sons of the sun? We are on the escalator of knowledge, and we cannot jump off now. The apocalypse is going to come long before the end of the world, in the shape of our realization about the origin of human intelligence. But what is possible for the human genome can also be at work in animals. For quite a number of years now, people have been making a good deal of fuss about dinosaurs. Since the film Jurassic Park, we are constantly hearing all sorts of theories and proofs about why they suddenly became extinct. About 200 million years ago, there were a very large number of dinosaur types, 12-meter-long carnivorous monsters which lived in Egypt, others with spikes and armor-plated shells. Plesiosaurus, with its small head and powerful tail fins, which was adapted to water, and the 30-meter-long, 12-meter-high Brachiosaurus. As many as 100 species existed, including the flying dinosaurs. Then, suddenly, without any warning, the whole lot died out about 64 million years ago. And this happened on all continents at once, as though some infection had broken out that just affected the dinosaurs and nothing else. There are no end of theories which try to explain this sudden extinction. The most recent one suggests that it might have been caused by a meteor colliding with the Earth. But why, then, were only the dinosaurs affected, and not all other creatures? In the film Jurassic Park, the stomach contents are extracted from a mosquito preserved in amber for millions of years. Because it had stung a dinosaur shortly before its death, its stomach contains some portions of dinosaur genes. These are transformed, hey presto, into new living dinosaurs. Such a thing is possible in fantasy, and even in theory, but one would need more basic material than a few snippets from a mosquito's stomach. To manufacture a dinosaur, about 50,000 genes to every 1,000 cell components would be necessary. And these are just not available, unless perhaps in a small bird. Jurassic Sparrow. The Munich paleontologist Dr. Peter Vellnhofer carried out investigations into a fossilized primeval bird, the Archaeopteryx. This bird is about 150 million years old, 40 centimeters long, and worth 2 million pounds. There are only 7 of them in the world, which puts the price up. Between the bird's teeth, Dr. Vellnhofer discovered triangular bone fragments which are typical of a quite different species, the carnivorous dinosaur Allosaurus. This convinced him that all bird species, from the sparrow to the condor, are descended from the dinosaurs. According to previous theories, birds are descended from the reptiles. I am not in a position to judge between differing opinions on this, but if birds are the descendants of dinosaurs, every sparrow would contain inherited gene material from these ancient creatures. Perhaps the geneticists will also discover why all the dinosaur species had to disappear from the surface of the Earth. Perhaps these monsters were some kind of threat to the Earth. Perhaps they would eventually have eaten absolutely everything, plants and other animals, and so rendered pre-human evolution impossible. Perhaps someone wanted to prevent an ideal planet like the Earth, neither too hot nor too cold, being dominated by huge, stupid creatures which offered no potential for developing intelligence and technology. Perhaps... What about human consciousness? How did it arise? 17 years ago, Dr. Julian Jaynes, professor of psychology at Princeton University, USA, posed this question and was met with a general shaking of heads from his colleagues. Consciousness? That just developed in the course of evolution. Really? But how did we become aware that we are? Is a clump of cells aware of its own existence? Consciousness has nothing to do with reflexes, fear responses, or tail wagging. Neither is it the sum of all memory processes. Consciousness does not arise through either experience or learning. We can feed an electronic brain as much information as we like, but it will not develop consciousness. James says, "Our periods of conscious awareness are really much shorter than we imagine. This is hard to realize since we are actually not conscious of our moments of unconsciousness. Our consciousness overlays these gaps with its broad net, giving us the illusion of consistency and continuity. One can compare non-consciousness with all the objects in a dark room, which are not illuminated by the beam of a torch. What then does consciousness consist of? How did it arise?" This question, like that about mathematical capability, remains unanswered. Only the human being, among all the creatures of the earth, is endowed with mathematical knowledge. The objection that this is quite logical, since we have to be able to count in order to bargain with each other and exchange goods, puts the cart before the horse. First, we have to have the capacity, and then we can make use of it. Animals, after all, have legs and claws, but no dog has yet thought of counting his sausages on his paws. Mathematical ability is the prerequisite for every science. Without it, nothing can be computed and compared. Dr. Max Flint, who engrosses himself in this question, explained it by means of an example. "Without higher mathematical abilities, we would be unable to land on another planet. Most ordinary people are unaware of the fact that it is impossible to send a spaceship to the Moon or Mars without calling on the highest degree of mathematical precision. The same is true of the shuttle flights and every satellite. The computations necessary for the precise angle of re-entry of the shuttle into the Earth's atmosphere is a perfect example of this, for on it depends the safety of human lives. If the angle is too steep, by even a fraction of a degree, the spaceship will turn into an inferno. If it is too shallow, the spaceship will bounce off the Earth's atmosphere and be catapulted out into space. This has much to do with evolution, since it is a fundamental tenet of evolutionary theory that no capacities develop by themselves without being needed at some point. There is no compelling reason, though, why mathematics was necessary for the survival of man's forerunners. Animals of all kinds survive without it, though not, for example, without a sense of smell. In space, on the other hand, survival is impossible without mathematics. And what applies to human space endeavors applies equally to extraterrestrials. If the Earth was once visited by aliens, these visitors must have been well versed in mathematics. This is why I consider our capacity for mathematics to be an indication that we are not only of earthly origin. The gods created us in their image. And suddenly, without even trying to address such questions, we find the answers in our own genes. Artificial intelligence. In the early summer of 1993, an unusual kind of group met together in the Austrian town of Linz. A few hundred computer specialists attended the Ars Electronica conference. This was not the normal kind of computer gathering that takes place continually all over the world. The meeting in Linz was concerned with artificial intelligence. Ulrich Gabriel of the Frankfurt Institute for New Medias demonstrated solar-powered cockroaches. These artificial creatures, directed by light sensors, gathered in groups, sniffed at each other, or carried out sudden backward movements whenever they collided with obstacles. For what purpose? The electronic system in these cockroaches was gathering experience. Tom Ray demonstrated how this functions with his computer program Tierra, Earth. From hundreds of commands, he composed an electronic strand similar to DNA that recreates or doubles itself. After 24 hours had elapsed, a kind of screen biotope had formed. Der Spiegel reported it as follows. First of all, a strand multiplied very fast and spread itself explosively through the electronic memory store. Then the fast mutations appeared, which were also capable of multiplying and of combating their forerunners. At last, computer parasites also entered the field, which only transmitted half the commands. These parasites occupy the Forerunner's program and use their reproduction code. Now the electronic mechanisms developed spectral defense reactions similar to an immune system, which were capable of blocking off the computer viruses before they destroyed the original program. And just as in life, the parasite population was decimated, and the whole process began all over again, except that now the program had been enriched by its experience with the parasites. The computer had vaccinated itself. These experiments show that artificial intelligence and life are possible. But what about consciousness? That must be a privilege of those life forms which are endowed with feeling. And feelings, in turn, are connected with bodily conditions directed by hormones. The hormones, in turn, are activated by our perceptions, in which our sense organs and personal experience combine. Artificial intelligence, on the other hand, knows nothing of hormones. True, it can compare different pieces of information with lightning speed, experience, and on that basis make correct deductions, learning. But it cannot feel, unless, of course, we fit it with a feeling body, in which case we would have nothing other than a life form. The brain of a computer, with its high-grade chips, is so sensitive to environmental factors, smoke, dampness, fluctuations in temperature, blows, foreign objects or animals, an ant in the works would cause chaos, that it must be protected by an outer housing. It is no different for life forms whose brain is surrounded by the bones of the skull. By receiving and exchanging information, the computer increases its knowledge, just like life forms, and can continue to do so for thousands of years. Let us look at a few historical dates in this connection. Human speech arose roughly 30,000 years ago as the first means of communication. The oldest rock paintings or carvings, the first visual forms of communication, are about 13,000 years old. The first form of script is only 5,000 years old. And 3,000 years ago, the first means of long-distance communication arose, in the form of smoke signals, fire and mirror signals. Printing was invented 500 years ago, and in the last century, telegraphic communication developed. Only in the last 100 years have we had moving pictures, films, and in the last 30, computers available for everyone. A very erudite scientist of the 18th century would have read about 200 books. He would have needed to keep up with only a very few specialist papers to remain abreast of his field. Nowadays, worldwide, more than 300,000 newspapers and magazines are in circulation. In addition, there are innumerable radio and TV programs, not to mention the yearly flood of specialist papers, theses, and books. The Library of Congress in Washington is stocked with 100 million documents, and all the other libraries of the world contain another 1,000 million. It is clear that no one can keep track of this deluge of information. And since the life expectancy of human beings, as well as the thousands of millions of human brain cells that each of us has, is not enough, we now store human knowledge outside the brain. Future generations will probably need to learn less than us, but instead will have to know how and where the information they need is stored. It must be the same for extraterrestrial life forms. Either they have brain cells like us, in which case their storage capacity is limited, or else they are a kind of computerized robot which can draw at will upon the information they need through a still larger computer. A third possibility would be a synthesis of both of these. Natural beings could be raised with attention paid to their genetic structure so that they develop an enormous brain capacity, which, however, is only used to a minimal degree. Why? The half-filled software capacity of a computer has storage space for new information. A human brain that uses only 20% of its capacity can be filled up with knowledge as required, if the gods so wish. They seem to wish it. And this brings me to the central point of my theme. In my last book, I discussed several UFO sightings and touched upon some accounts of abduction. Let me just briefly recap. Not right in the head? For over 30 years, according to UFO literature, there have been frequent cases of people who assert with absolute certainty that they have been abducted by aliens, medically examined and interfered with in the genital region, not abused or raped, but investigated, as though they were in a laboratory. Male abduction victims were convinced that sperm samples had been taken from them. Females spoke of pregnancy tests, sucking out procedures, and even of artificially created pregnancies. In the latter case, the growing fetus was operatively removed some weeks later. Naturally, no one took these reports seriously. We all know that people can harbor secret sexual dreams, wishes, and fantasies, and doctors are familiar with the phenomenon of false pregnancy. It is also quite possible that some women may become pregnant but not want to divulge who the father is, so they use the ET excuse, even though no one believes them. Telling such a story might also make one feel special or chosen, or even that immaculate conception has occurred. In the last 3 decades, I have been content to dismiss all such stories as amusing fabrications, not bothering to ask myself what extraterrestrials might want human genetic material for. But it is very likely that I was wrong, for what seemed the product of weak minds has recently received some methodical substantiation. In 1987, the American author Bud Hopkins presented the results, supported by several scientists of many years of research. People he interviewed described, sometimes under hypnosis, how genetic material had been siphoned off from them. There are cases in which the same person was abducted 3 times over the years, at puberty, as a young man, and as a 35-year-old. If this is true, and I still reserve judgment, it would mean the person had been ringed by aliens, just as we ring birds, dolphins, or bears. Shortly after Hopkins published his research, other authors reported on similar horror stories. Not only individuals, but also whole families had apparently been abducted by strange lights. The victims floated about in brightly lit rooms. The men's genital region was covered in some rubber-like substance and subjected to sucking movements. In other cases, they were sexually stimulated by a very pretty woman, and even mounted. Whenever I broached the subject of abductions with my acquaintances, they started to laugh. Our intellect is not well disposed towards abductions by ETs, still less towards their experimenting upon us in such ways. The whole thing sounds too far-fetched. People who think there are no such things as aliens are not, of course, going to be convinced by such stories. They know, with a sleepwalker's certainty, that UFOs do not and cannot exist. They put up total insurmountable barriers which no argument can penetrate. And people who do think UFOs might exist find the abduction stories weird, grotesque, and crazy. They do not see any reason for ETs to behave like this, even if there are such beings. But I am afraid that we are going to have to rethink our attitude, and this revising of our ideas has a good deal to do with our brain, with the capacity of our gray matter, with genetic intervention, as well as with the return of the gods and their prophets. Dr. Johannes Fiebig, trained as a scientist, has investigated recent abduction cases in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, among them the Berlin woman, Maria Struve. Fiebig describes her as a good-looking woman, intelligent, attentive, critical, not reserved, but keeping her own distance from the events she describes. Maria Struve recounts a dream, although she was also simultaneously aware that it was not a dream at all. She lay upon a kind of operating table. To the right and left of her stood small alien beings with large heads and big eyes. At this time she was pregnant with her 3rd child. At least, she thought she was. She was familiar with all the signs of pregnancy from her previous experience of childbirth, and she had also consulted a gynecologist. Then this dreadful dream occurred. The large-headed aliens removed the embryo from her. She woke up in her own bed, bathed in sweat, as though she had suffered an appalling nightmare. Shortly afterwards, she visited her doctor, who discovered with astonishment that she was no longer pregnant. All symptoms of pregnancy stopped at once. 2 weeks later, Mrs. Struve excreted 2 lumps of flesh. She assumed that these were the remains of the placenta and flushed them down the toilet. After some time, the Struve couple decided to try again for a third child. But since all natural means were unsuccessful, in contrast to previous pregnancies, they decided to proceed with artificial fertilization. This was to happen on the 22nd of February, 1988. But it caused such inexplicable pain to her that the process was halted. Yet 2 weeks later, Mrs. Struve excreted 2 transparent skins whose origin was unknown. And then, suddenly, as though by divine intervention, she became pregnant once more, on the 12th of May, 1988. On the 9th of January, 1989, she gave birth to her 3rd child, Sebastian. Dr. Feebog suggests various explanations, among which is the following scenario. In the summer of 1986, Mrs. Struve was pregnant. In the 3rd month of pregnancy, the ETs extracted the embryo. The aliens implanted some kind of skin in her womb, which was intended to prevent further pregnancies. This is why she failed to become pregnant either by natural or artificial means. But these barriers were excreted, and normal pregnancy could then follow. All these events could be explained away as an unusual pregnancy, if it were not for Sebastian. This little boy kept telling his parents of strange dreams, peopled by monsters with big heads and large eyes. He relates that he has seen little children in boxes, also that he has been flying in the air and that the monsters have poured fluids into him. They converse with him through his lungs, which probably means in some kind of internal way. When Dr. Feebog showed the boy some drawings depicting various kinds of ETs, he immediately identified the little ones with the large heads and eyes. Mrs. Struve assured Dr. Feebog that she had never spoken to Sebastian about her dream or about extraterrestrials with large heads and outsized eyes. So what is going on? The researches of Dr. Feebog in German-speaking countries are paralleled by the investigation of Professor David Jacobs in America. He believes that the sperm extractions and artificial fertilizations are the reason for all the abductions, the aim being to create a half-human, half-alien life form. The reported cases are increasing. There are not hundreds, but thousands of them. So is it just a passing craze? If so, why suddenly now? Have thousands of people who do not even know each other, who live in different continents, suddenly all have been infected by the same madness? Do all these cases have a psychological explanation?